Thank you. Hi, welcome to the Contemporary Art Show on Brighton's Radio Reverb 97.2 FM or www.radioreverb.com. I'm Alistair Kemp, and today in the studio we have Ivan Fabrega and Dorothy Max Pryor from the Ragroof Theatre Company, who will be discussing their productions and the tea dances they are due to put on in Jubilee Square in August. The music you just heard was Cohen, as in K-O-N, umlaut H-N, from the album Cohen, K-O-E-N, on the label Quark 3, with the track Fart, as in the German for journey. First though, here are this month's art listings. At Inked on North Road, we have Zachary Walsh with his exhibition Greek Street, starting 31st of July and continuing until 23rd of August. It's figurative paintings of people in Zachary's life, but based on the imagery of Greek mythology, especially around the Greek goddess. The great goddess, should I say. At Brighton's Grey Area Gallery on Queens Road, there is an exhibition, Empty Space, of photographic work by Eva Kalpadaki, whose work Empty Space explores the relationship of the abstract photographic image to the inner world, and also notions of exteriority and interiority as these relate to the transition from the unconscious to conscious reality. Anyway, this work is based in part on the work of psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott. The exhibition is from the 25th of July to the 9th of August. Continuing at the Phoenix Square with the exhibitions The Fabric of War, Silver Mount Sketches and Out of the Blue. This exhibition continues until the 15th of August. I should apologise, as last month I stated that Cyril's sketches were based on his wartime experience in North America. I should have said North Africa. Also continuing at the Fabric Gallery on Ship Street is the exhibition by American artist John Grade called The Elephant Bed, based on coccolithophores, the microscopic organisms responsible for the chalk on the South Downs. This exhibition continues until the 31st of August. I just popped in there earlier on Wednesday and had a look, and the exhibits are slowly decaying into the water, and the artist plans to take the remaining exhibits or sculptures into the sea at the end of the show on the 31st. I'll give more details on the next show, which is on the 23rd of August. In music next month, we have the Safe House crew again, presenting the Beatabet Collective on the 29th of July at the Open House Pub on Springfield Road. On August the 6th, experimental electronic outfit They Cried Land, playing with Dan Shears and Buzz at the Prince Albert from 8 p.m. On the 20th of August, the Spirit of Gravity guys present HRT, Matthew Noonit and the VLK at the Comedia Studio Bar. That's from 8:30 and that's £5 entry. And lastly, for you culture theorists, the Centre for Social and Political Thought at the University of Sussex is putting on a conference entitled Adorno 40 Years On. The talks include Professor Max Patterson on aesthetics, politics and the ideology of nature, Professor Alexander Duetman on Kafka or Adorno and the life of the letter, as well as Dr. Drew Milne on ideology and idealects, Adorno and the grammar of argument. Details can be found at www.adorno2009.blogspot.com. The conference is on August the 6th. It is free, but you must RSVP. The email address to RSVP2 is s.p.muscle@sussex.ac.uk. That's s.p.muscle@sussex.ac.uk. After the break, we'll be interviewing Ivan and Dorothy, but next is some music. What is this, Ivan?
This is a cha-cha by Xavier Cugat.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
Hi, in the studio with me I have Ivan and Dorothy from Rag Roof Theatre, a Bryson company that puts on performance pieces based on the memories they have gathered from people who attended tea dances in their 20s, 30s and 40s. And I understand that you will also be putting on tea dance in Jubilee Square this summer from the 1st of August. Could you tell me a bit more about yourselves and your company?
Well, the company's called Rag Roof Theatre and it initially began in 2001. There's three other members, Anna Symes, Luann Blake and Marion Duggan, and we all went to the college here at the University of Art, and I actually joined later on. They started the company quite soon after they'd left, and their first show was called Make, Do and Mend, and that was based on memories of women. It was based on older women's memories about the 40s. Mainly the war period, and they created this show which had a button museum in it, and it was more or less that. And then later on, when I joined, we created a show called Shall We Dance, which was a large scale piece that outdoor site specific show that toured around with a movable portable bandstand and dance floor, which we still have and still tour, and it was based on people's memories of the dance hall era and of partner dancing from the 1920s to the 1950s. It's essentially now we're doing a new piece based on boxers' memories. So our company isn't solely to do with the dance, with tea dances, but the tea dance is something that came out of Shall We Dance.
But histories and memories of people's experiences are a large part of the
Yeah, that's where we get our material for all the shows. That is definitely the common denominator.
And something I picked up looking at your website, you're called the Rag Roof Theatre because your first show, or the first show, was in 2CV.
Yeah, that was actually the show that they first created when they left college, which was a 2CV with a soft top, and they went into around France, around festivals in France, and it was essentially them popping out of the having various sketches that centered around the car, and the car in I think it's Swedish or Finnish or something, one of those languages, Northern European languages. Rag Roof is the nickname for a 2CV. So that's where it comes from.
Brilliant. Okay. And you have a as you say, you have a lot of shows. I mean, the main ones, Make, Do and Mend and Shall We Dance, but you've got the boxes one coming up. But with the Shall We Dance, you've got a document. Yeah, things like documentation booths as well.
Yeah, that also features in most of the shows, if not all. A documentation booth where, because the shows always begin with quite a lot of research, where we go out into the community and in the case of Shall We Dance, meeting older people. Whether it's at tea dances or at old people's homes or wherever we can find them, and record their memories, and then those memories and take photographs and sometimes video, and so for instance, in the Shall We Dance, there's a booth that's kind of next door to the dance floor, where. It's like a living room. It's set up like a 1940s living room, and inside it there's chairs and a bureau, and you can sit in the chairs and put headphones on and listen to the people's memories, or in the bureau there's a small television video playing back stuff from that era. So it's kind of like it's attached, and that's an extra kind of source that shows people. Gives people another dimension to the show itself, because at the end of the day, it's all coming from, people's real memories and real stories. That's where it all comes from. The shows themselves.
Okay. Well, I mean, you've got this new boxer show coming through, which we'll talk about in a bit. But you also put on the tea dances in Jubilee Square in August, and it is the 1st of August. Is that right?
Yeah, Saturday the 1st of August.
What inspired you to look at tea dances in the first place?
Well, like I say, it was it was Shall We Dance that we wanted to create a show about partner dancing, and we knew very little about it then. We knew that older people had tea dances, and we just started going and finding them, you know, finding these places that were in village halls or wherever, and it was through experiencing that we thought, and through creating Shall We Dance, that we thought we could create our own tea dance and bring something a bit more contemporary into it. Because one of the main inspirations for the show was the fact that we really believe that partner dancing is a very important part of culture, and that it might be lost if we didn't, you know, not just us, but if it wasn't kept alive. And so that was a big inspiration for the whole show, was what a beautiful thing partner dancing is and how it needs to be kept alive, and how if you go to a lot of these tea dances, it is just older people. So obviously, like, there's a whole modern kind of resurgence of interest going on, but, you know, this is like four years ago, So that was the inspiration to start doing tea dances, was to get younger people involved, and also to create, you know, an alternative venue for the older tea dancers to come and to mix. And that's another very important part of why we do it, is to mix the generations of the older and younger people, and everyone in between.
Okay, so for the younger viewers who may not know what a tea dance is, I mean, could you say what a tea dance is, and also tell me a bit about, say, the history of tea dances?
Well, Dorothy.
Well, the tea dances are, I suppose the kind of definition is that they're social dances that take place in the afternoon or early evening rather than a kind of nighttime, nightclubby environment. They've got a bit of a kind of history of subversion and alternative practice anyway. Some sources say that tea dances started in kind of colonial places, you know,
France,
sort of French, yeah, the French colonies in North Africa and things like this. Often they were just like things that just sort of set up almost in a speakeasy kind of quite impromptu sort of way. There's a lot of kind of just setting something up on a street corner or in a warehouse. So it's quite interesting really, because it does tie into the whole, like, things like the kind of 80s warehouse parties and the whole beginning of house and all that sort of thing. The idea that you turn up with, well, you know, something that makes sound or live musicians or whatever, you find an empty space and you do not ask permission to do this.
Right.
You just go out and do it. I mean, obviously there's also the other end of the whole thing, where you get the very kind of high-flying, you know, sort of beautiful, you know, gorgeous palm court hotels and all that sort of thing.
Right.
But actually, really, they started with people just setting things up and just getting on with it and doing it.
I was going to say, because, I mean, you know, you mentioned that it was perhaps coming from the French side, but also there was also another one that came from the afternoon teas, or something to do with afternoon tea, which was a very upper class thing. But then it kicked off. But it got bigger at about the time that not working class, but lower middle class, and wages, especially amongst women, single women before they got married, were rising. And so, it was after the Victorian era, which was quite controlling as far as the men were concerned. And it was concurrent with stuff like the Women's Lib, suffragettes, shall I say, that's the 60s, isn't it? Suffragettes, post-suffragettes, about the time that just after they got the vote after the First World War.
Yeah, that whole same era that, you know, was the kind of, you know, the whole sort of Charleston thing. I mean, at the same time in different places throughout the world, you really have the development of kind of Charleston, Lindy Hop, and then you have the development of the tango. And it's basically just about people getting together and creating new dances. And one of the things that's interesting about it is the kind of cultural exchange, you know, where, I mean, like, the whole history of tango is very much a history of kind of emigration and intermingling, you know, and where you get the kind of, you know, you get European settlers in Buenos Aires, and then that mixing up with what's already been happening there musically, and with what's happening next door in Uruguay, and, you know, and then it gets fed back to Paris, and then it comes back again, and so there's nothing kind of pure about it. It's all about kind of mixing of music and mixing of dances
and
mixing of cultures, really, you know, and breaking down. I mean, people would kind of get together and dance together that wouldn't in other social situations be allowed to be together. You know, and the whole kind of, really, I mean, if it hadn't been for all this, then there'd be no rock and roll, you know, because, I mean, that's where it can be traced back to. It can be traced back to those kind of dance halls, you know, and the sort of Charleston, Lindy Hop and whatever, and people, you know, borrowing tunes from each other, borrowing dance moves from each other.
Okay, brilliant. Well, as you were saying, you mentioned the Charleston, and there was the waltzes and the tangos and stuff, and they follow a lot of dance fashions. Ivan, you've got some more music.
Yeah.
What's this next one?
This is an Argentinian tango.
This is a tango.
Yeah, it's a tango, and it's called Nostalgia, and it's by Florindo Sassoni.
You were just talking before about the influence on contemporary culture of tea dances, and if you could talk a bit more about that. I mean, what influences have tea dances have on contemporary culture?
Well, I see it as one kind of continuum, really. You can take any dance, any of the sort of strands of dances from whatever country, and you can sort of. You can track where it's gone and how it's ended up in contemporary music. For example, if you take the whole kind of like samba and Brazilian and bossa nova, whatever, and you see how those rhythms are actually very similar to kind of early funk and soul, and you can see how that then goes into disco, and then you get the crossover back again, where you get the there was a great big movement, a decade or two ago in New York, where you had the whole kind of samba house thing happening. So you have so things kind of evolve, and then they get fed back again into that original culture, which then regurgitates and retreats it and makes it into something different.
Mm.
So that's one kind of strand that you could trace, samba through to disco through to house. Similarly, you can trace the whole kind of Charleston and jazz era, which is kind of quite interesting because you've got interesting to think that's the beginning of 4/4 time, and before that it didn't exist. You know, it's just rather bizarre now because almost everything is 4/4 nowadays. But so you have this whole kind of genre of things that come directly from the jazz era and from Charleston, and obviously Lindy Hop, and And just bug and jive and swing, whatever, but and also the more, you know, sedate foxtrots and quick steps and things, but they're all sort of intermingled and interrelated to each other.
Okay. You're talking about, because you know, you are talking about partner dancing, and you're talking about the early, it wasn't 4/4 beats, and the reason you're talking about bringing back partner dancing is the fact that we have a lot of people dance on their own. They dance with people, but they dance to their own rhythm. Well, they were not their own rhythm music, but you know, with themselves to an extent. Mm. I mean, and you were talking about house music as well, because you do get house compilations that are called tea dances, and that is from the gay culture, the history of disco through to. And that was...
That's, I think, that ties up what I was saying earlier about that kind of time with the whole warehouse party and the speakeasy and thing, because it's... I think the tea dance has got numerous meanings, but as we said earlier, there is the very, you know, the sort of posh end of it, you know, with the palm court orchestra and everything. But, I mean, a whole important part of history was the notion, turn up and play, you know, and just kind of have a sort of secret place to go to, you know, where you could sky off work in the afternoon and go and drink some whiskey out of a teacup and get up and tango.
And dance.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then as you say, there's now another whole sort of strand that you can trace right back really to the very early days of tango, of the whole kind of gay culture. I mean, tango, because of its kind of its history as being you know, at one point in its development seen as socially unacceptable and low class, whatever, and then something that nice ladies didn't do, so it's only kind of whores, you know, and then a lot of the time it was men practicing their steps together in street corners, you know, all this very well documented history. But it's a very iconic image of the two men dancing together. Something that we've actually taken, and I mean, you were talking about kind of contemporary reinventions or whatever, but some of our dance routines are quite kind of reasonably conventional ones, but we do kind of subvert and play with the form as well. We've got an all male tango, and we've got, you know, an all woman rumba routine and things like that. So we like to kind of to sort of play around with the form anyway. But yeah, tango particularly has become something of a kind of, it's got something of a kind of iconic status in the gay community.
But that's something we haven't mentioned, actually, is that within the tea dances and the structure of the tea dances that we do, it's not just people getting up and dancing. There is a certain amount of that, but also we structure it so that we do dance displays, and Dorothy teaches short, like 15-minute lessons.
You give lessons.
Yeah, that was also something that in Shall We Dance, when we created the show, Dorothy was our choreographer and dramaturge, and she's an expert ballroom dancer. So she was the one who taught us most of the dances that we do in the show, in Shall We Dance. And then coming out of that, the tea dances that we do, because we do them in places where you get a lot of experienced dancers, but you get a lot of people who don't dance at all, particularly the younger people. And so what's kind of unique to the tea dances that we do is that, and it's through having done them over the years that we've kind of come to this formula, with, as opposed to how a lot of these events are put on, where you have dance class at the beginning for an hour and then people just dance, we put them in throughout. We kind of have like two or three lessons throughout, just short ones, which get everyone up, and so that it makes it much more of a inclusive kind of party atmosphere.
Okay, and if it's quiet, it also means it brings people back on the dance floor.
Exactly.
It's very much about kind of, I mean, I'm very interested, you know, artistically, I'm very interested in the notion of breaking down the divide between the performer and the audience, and in forms like carnival and like street arts and like this sort of work, that immersive theatre, to use a sort of art speak term, that does challenge those boundaries between the stage and the audience. Yeah. You know, so it's quite hard to be merely audience, to be passive. You know, it's more than that. Yeah, it's just blurring the boundaries really, and it's something that's very much part of contemporary performance culture, with companies like Punch Drunk, you know, creating kind of site specific immersive theatre events. I'll say one thing as well, just harping back to what we were saying about the gay culture as well, is another thing I think. That's quite different about how we do things is whenever I'm teaching, I always teach tea is another kind of jargon term, non-gender specific kind of roles. Mm. I always teach everybody to lead and teach everybody to follow.
Okay.
And then say, well, you can choose, you know, and then when I partner people up or I get people to partner up, I just say, turn to the newest person, doesn't matter if they're a boy or a girl, you know, just choose between you who's going to lead, who's going to follow. And, you know, a lot of the time people choose to maybe to take a conventional role, but that's their choice.
Mm.
I mean, I try and actually set up a situation in which we're saying that your, you know, gender assignment is a game, it's a choice. You know, you can do what you want, you know.
I mean, I should say the reason I brought up the gay thing was to do with a history that I came across,
yeah.
Which was that in New York, when they had the gay tea party, when homosexuality was illegal,
yeah.
When you had the mixed gay tea parties, then if it got raided, then the men could start. As soon as it was ready to start performing with the women, and then it would just look like a normal tea dance,
mm.
and everything would be right, okay. But then some groups, some of them, in fact, more upper class groups, started dancing on their own, and they'd still get raided, so all of a sudden they'd start dancing on their own. And I did come across the argument while researching the programme, this is one of the starts of dancing on your own, that became the tea parties with a t-shirt, dancing.
Mm-hmm.
What's
moved on into into
what sort of era would that have been then?
1930s, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Although you could, yeah, possibly. I mean, there's always more than one answer to everything. I suppose you could also say, though, that in the 1920s, one of the things about Charleston and Lindy Hop is you had, you know, you were kind of like dancing with a partner, but then you'd get the kind of break,
like people,
which is equivalent to,
anyway.
As you got the kind of,
yeah.
jazz break with the instrumental jazz breaks, also with what the dancers were doing, with set up things where they kind of move away from each other and move together again, and they have like a little sort of almost like a solo spot within the dance, you know.
Mm.
So there's all that happening as well.
Okay.
Something I was just going to say is that in the social world of dancing, something that we found in Shall We Dance, in the interviewing people about their memories of that era, which was more 30s, 40s, going into 50s, where people tended to meet their partners was at the dance halls, because even though I'm sure all that crazy stuff was going on in New York, you know, your general,
yeah.
you know, Doris and Derek down the road.
In a sense, though, isn't it? Same as meeting your partner to a club.
Yeah, kind of. But what was different in those days is that you couldn't really go over and start speaking to people of the opposite sex, or certainly women wouldn't go over to a group of men and start chatting to them in the way that you do nowadays.
Yeah,
so what you had, you're very structured, you know, like just up the road from here, the Boots Chemist at the top of the hill there, that used to be a big ballroom, and we spoke to quite a few different people who told us these great stories about, you know, they went there and it would just be all the men kind of sat down along one side and all the women sat along the other side, and then it would be, and you'd have your groups of men, you know, your Moleskine boys and your White Hawk boys, and that was all going on in the 30s, you know, and 40s still. And then the men would, you know, go over and ask the women to dance, and you know, that whole culture, and that was how a lot of people met their future partners. And the thing is that to my knowledge, and from redoing that kind of research, kind of heard that it wasn't till the late 50s, early 60s when 60s music, basically 60s psychedelic music, and that kind of came in, that people stopped dancing together, and that, so you know, I don't know whether that, how that relates,
yeah.
to kind of what was going on in America, but that was certainly something that, you know, kind of like what we came across when we were doing our research, and something that, again, we really inspired us and made us want to bring back partner dancing, because we thought it's something that's really lost. It's a beautiful thing to be able to go over and ask someone to dance who's a stranger and dance with them, and if you know the dance more or less, you know, you have a communication together which you wouldn't necessarily have just by going and trying talking to them. And then you have your dance, then you say thank you, you go back to their chair, and it's like you might not talk to them again, but you've had this kind of communication, and it's an amazing thing which goes on in the tea dance, you know, goes on in our tea dances, goes on in the tea dances is, and in partner dancing all round, is that you can have that thing where more often than not after your dance you won't actually necessarily speak to them, or maybe you will, maybe you'll start chatting, but it's kind of a whole other level of communication which is lost if partner dancing is lost.
Yeah, those moments with somebody you're not going to meet again.
Yeah,
or something, the fact that it's non-verbal.
Or the beginning.
Like you will either never meet again or something can come from it.
Yeah.
And that dance is where it gets decided, perhaps.
Yeah, or a whole evening or an afternoon or whatever. I mean, it isn't just about meeting people, but it's about, you know, but in a way it is. It's a social dance, you know, it's a social thing.
I mean, you're talking about wanting to bring back dance. Dancing. I mean, what do you think shows like Strictly Come Dancing, and what impact do you think they've had on what you like to do? You know,
well, it's culture? Positive, definitely. What do you think?
Yeah, it's really interesting that so many people are now, of course, interested in part of dancing because they've come across it through shows like Strictly Come Dancing. But the thing is, I think that. One thing that always amuses me, I think it's always really interesting, is that we live in supposedly a very liberated and very sexualised culture, and you'll get people who've maybe seen, you know, Strictly Come Dancing on television, and therefore they come along to tea dance and they get off their first lesson, and you can see they're quite taken aback by the intimacy that is actually expected of them with another human being, you know, that despite this supposedly liberated culture, they actually find it quite hard to really kind of get in actually physically very close with someone that they've never met before and haven't even spoken to before. So that's kind of quite an interesting aspect of it, really, that it is physically really intimate, you know.
I was going to say there's a certain sense where the sexuality of our modern day is a slightly alienated sexuality compared to that which forms.
Well, my own view is a contemporary sexuality is very much a sexuality of the eye. You know, it's very much about the look, it's about the perfect body, it's about, you know, having a certain look, it's about, you know, we could go down that route, but it's not part of this. But the thing about partner dancing is it's actually closer to physical sexuality, it's about real intimacy with people. You know, obviously it's different to sex, but it is obviously on the spectrum. You know, it is part of the same thing of actually making contact with other human beings, which is very, very different. And it is interesting that people who are, you know, brought up now, it's on, you know, almost brought up on porn or whatever, are actually have very little physical intimacy with other people.
Perhaps it scares them off. I was going to change the subject. Keeping to the topic. I mean, we were talking about Strictly. I brought up Strictly Come Dancing because also sort of like partner dancing is sort of used in performance, on stage theatre performances, in dance performance.
Mm.
And although they still use the classic forms, they reinterpret or deconstruct or reconstruct the forms, and that's where the forms of dance are kind of changing. But because of things like Strictly Come Dancing, the popular partner dancing still seems to be the old classic forms. I mean, is there a reason for this, do you think? Or is this strictly true? Am I talking absolutely rubbish?
No, I think, we need to differentiate between something like Strictly Come Dancing is very much tied in with the classic ballroom dancing one, which is a very specific thing that developed after the Second World War in England, where a number of people, because there's so many dance rhythms and there's so many possibilities and so many steps, and there's basically as many steps as there are dancers. So a group of very well-known dancers got together, you know, and formed the Imperial Society of Teachers of Dance, and the kind of director of that for many years was Victor Sylvester, who I believe we're going to have a track from in a minute with immaculate and perfect timing. And so this was basically people getting together and going, okay, well, what we need to do is to make some sense out of this so that it's something that's teachable. So then the Imperial Society of Teachers of Dancing came up with a set number of dances. They dictated what was the kind of number of beats per minute, BPM, and they said what the steps had to be, and they became fixed, you know, gold, silver and bronze steps and all that sort of thing, and that became like a very fixed world, and that world still exists almost like a little nutshell with very, you know, very little change. There might be different costumes and makeup and different tunes played, but essentially those sort of rules that were laid down at that point are still very much what the whole formal ballroom, competitive dancing, medals, and Strictly Come Dancing is directly linked into that world. So there's only a certain number of dance rhythms. You can only do those dance rhythms at a certain tempo,
right.
And you have to do fixed steps. And it's a bit like, it is actually quite closely related to sport, because if you're in competition ballroom dancing, you get actually marked on your, you know, your cross chassis and lock or whatever, and you know,
okay.
How, whether, and you have exact alignments, so it has to be done exactly this way and that way,
you know.
So that's just there's nothing wrong with it. It's just what it's got its own complete set of rules.
And then separate world to an extent.
Yeah, and there is crossover with other worlds, but meanwhile in other worlds, for example, you're talking about tango earlier. I mean, Ivan can probably talk a bit more about it because he's just been to Buenos Aires for a few months, but in tango, you've got so many parallel developments, because you've got the classic, as in classic 1920s, but then you've got another type of classic where you've got pizzaiolo, you know, in the kind of 30s and the more loungy sort of stuff, and then you have another wave of stuff that came in like 10 years after that, and that those waves are still happening. So you've got contemporary dancers, and the music is actually, if you heard it, you wouldn't even recognise it perhaps as tango, other than it's got some of the same instruments, but the actual rhythm is completely different to the rhythms of like 50 years ago, and people are choreographing to that, really things that have some of the same steps, but it's really quite a revolutionary sort of
thing.
That brings into the
next question I was going to ask, you know, sort of like, because my understanding of partner dancing comes from things that's really strictly come dancing, because I haven't been to a tea dance.
Mm.
I mean, so what you're saying is, if someone comes to a tea dance, then really they can dance how they want, as long as they dance to the music, although there may be steps that people use. But I mean, and you're talking about the tango is mutating into new forms in Argentina, and I mean, because I was going to say if partner dancing was to come back in this country, you know, and in a big way, then rather than just rehashing the old style and then just being a form of nostalgia, I mean what I'm thinking is with partner dancing, it was always the dances that changed, and then, as you were saying, since the 60s with psychedelia and stuff, the music changed with the dances, but now it's just about the music changing. The dances is pretty much in dancing, where people dance on their own, It's about the music changing. It's not about the way people dance, although there are dances with it. There's a certain sense where the focus at least is on the different types of music rather than on the different types of dancing. When you go to a club like a dubstep or drum and bass, you don't think about how you can dance, you think about what the music is. Whereas with partner dancing, it was often a lot about the dances were. And so what I was going to say was that if partner dancing was to come back in this country, then perhaps a sign of it would be for a new dance, partner dance craze or form.
Well, I think there is already. I mean, there is already very much so. There is, well, there's tango, for instance, which is definitely evolving. There's new tango, which has got modern music, modern dance, and that is constantly changing. There's Lindy Hop and swing and rock and roll, which is huge and getting bigger all the time. I'm not so sure about how much that is evolving, but certainly there's a lot of, it's getting more and more popular, and I think people are definitely pushing the boundaries with that, you know, in terms of physically.
The thing is, often things evolve in one direction, then people change their minds and actually step back. So, for example, with rock and roll, what happened is 20 years ago, you had a massive great thing of Ciroc and Le Rock, which is so-called French rock and roll, which had a sort of different, you know, some of the same steps, but a different kind of rhythm and feel, and that was kind of like modern rock and roll. But actually now the fashion has become to actually revert back before that, and they've kind of become a little bit old and tired.
Okay.
You know, so it's just, and the same thing's happening with the kind of whole Cuban stuff, because you had salsa, which was massive I went to New York, I was working there in the late 70s, early 80s when it was all first happening. So that is an example of a whole new set of steps that's coming out of an amalgam of dance rhythms, and that's happening very much in the kind of Puerto Rican community and also in the jazz community in New York, you know, places like the Village Gate and other clubs like that. So you had the whole evolution of the salsa thing, and then that came over a few years later to London, massive great thing, and now it's everywhere.
Okay.
You know, salsa clubs in every corner. What's happening now, Ry Cooder went back over and he started recording the older generation with purer rhythms.
Yeah.
And I'm personally more interested in the purer cha-chas and mambos that the salsa developed from. It's not that I dislike salsa, you know, it's just like I kind of did it a couple of decades ago, and then I was kind of like, then I just got much more into those, really, those older rhythms. So it's all about a kind of personal taste. I mean, the same way I think, you know, with Ivan and the music that Fat 45's playing, whatever, is kind of, you find your own, you know, sort of ideal era within things, and then you maybe work
you
with that, and you still evolve
it.
It and change it, but it's kind of like that's where your heart is, perhaps. I don't know if you want to say something about that.
Well, we're going to have to round up the interview, so if you want to tell everybody about your tea dances, your tours of your production company, and then if you can introduce the next track.
Yeah, okay. This coming Saturday, well, the 1st of August and the 5th of September, the first Saturdays of the month, we're having a tea dance in Jubilee Square from 1 till 4, where we will be having, as we were saying, Dorothy in Dorothy's Shoes doing some teaching some ballroom dancing, etc. And we'll be having tea and cakes there as well. And then we're also doing events at the Windmill Theatre, Blatchington Mill School, in the autumn. Which we were doing last year as well, but we're going to continue doing that.
So we've got Sunday the 4th of October for that, and Sunday the 15th of November. And also, we know that this show is going out on Sunday, but if you want to leap out of your house down to Jubilee Square, there's an event that's related to the new show, Gloves On.
Yeah, Ragroof Theatre's new show is called Gloves On, and it's we're going to have lots of boxers and representing their clubs from all around Brighton. We're going to have a ring set up there, and all the kids down there boxing. So if you want to come and check that out, that's going to be the inspiration for our new show called Gloves On.
And thank you, Ivan and Dorothy. What's this next track?
this next track is called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and it's by Victor Sylvester, who we were saying was
the main man for the kind of in the heyday of traditional ballroom dancing.
Brilliant. Okay, here we go. Thank you for listening. This has been the Contemporary Art Show on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM or www.radioreverb.com. I've been Alistair Kemp. You can email me at studio@radioreverb.com. Put Contemporary Art Show in the subject heading. This last track, or as much as we've got time for it, is Phil Niblock with Guitar 2x4, the Torrell version from the album G2, 44+x2 on Moikai. See you next month, which will be the 23rd of August.